I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 festival.
Yiridumarung, Yuandu Yanadahais, Baladuwaradri Gilung, Aramajibul Brungalibul, Miyagandi Bala Williams, Indamaladul, Balgo Balgagalangbul, Balagirbangbul, Balambangbul, Bulwaradri, Nirumbangbul, Yinjamadadul, Gadigulgul, Eoragul, Mangul. Good morning, everybody. My name is Anita Heiss, and I have Wiradjuri belonging from Arambi and Brungal missions in central New South Wales. I'm a Williams. I have respect for my elders, my ancestors, those who have passed over, and Wiradjuri country. And on behalf of the panel today and everyone here, I'd like to acknowledge the Gadigal clan of the Eora Nation, on whose country we come together today to share stories and the process of storytelling. Thank you.
Thank you, Anita, for that beautiful acknowledgement and welcome to us all. Hi, everyone. My name is Rowana Gonsalves. I'm delighted to be here in conversation with the Anita Heiss and the Meg Keneally. As you all know, but I will say this anyway, Anita Heiss is an award-winning author of non-fiction, historical fiction, commercial women's fiction, children's novels and poetry. She is a proud member of the Wiradjuri Nation and a board member of the University of Queensland Press and Circa Contemporary Circus. Anita is Professor of Communications at the University of Queensland and an ambassador for the Indigenous Literacy Foundation and the GO Foundation. She's currently adapting her novel, Tidas, for the stage. Her latest novel, and Anita is going to guide us through the pronunciation of the title, but I will have a go. Should I have a go?
Please.
Do I dare to?
Yes.
I will. Bila Yaradangalang Durai, River of Dreams, in translation. And so, thank you for being here, Anita.
Thank you for having me.
Meg Keneally has always been fascinated by the ocean and by history, in particular maritime history and archaeology. A former scuba diving instructor, Meg still spends as much time underwater as she can. Meg has worked as a public affairs officer, sub-editor, freelance feature writer, reporter, and talkback radio producer before co-founding a financial service public relations company, which she then sold after having her first child. For more than 10 years, Meg has worked in corporate affairs for listed financial services companies. She is co-author with her father, Thomas Keneally, who is here with us in the audience today, of the Montserrat series of historical mysteries. Meg's first solo novel, Fled, was published in 2019, and her most recent novel is The Wreck. Thank you for being here, Meg.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And congratulations to Anita on your book birthday. Happy book birthday.
Oh, thank you.
As I was reading both books, and we realized that there are many resonances with the covers as well, so you can see, I found that both books explore aspects of Australian colonization from the perspectives of those that history has often refused to listen to. I personally found each book quite illuminating about the specific historical incidents around which the stories pivot. The Peterloo Massacre in Manchester in 1819, and the shipwreck in your book, Meg, and the flooding of the Murrumbidgee River in 1852, in your book, Anita, among other things. There is this beautiful exploration of the role of water, the connection that water provides, as well as the great and terrible destruction that a body of water can inflict upon people. It's the river that gives and also taketh away. And in The Wreck, it is the ocean that is the source of destruction, but also of escape and renewal. However, what the point of greatest connection was between both your books, Anita and Meg, was that each story that you're telling, or the multiple stories that each of you are telling, are focalized through very complex, flawed, yet absolutely riveting characters. Wongadine and Louisa, in your work, Anita, and Sarah and Mrs. Thistle in your work, Meg, among many, many other complex characters. You give them to us as people with histories and relationships and political affiliations and emotional ties that they carry with them into the royal of the story, as in one way or another they search for home. And I was also quite intrigued, actually, by the way in which you both handle power. you both discuss and render the perpetuation of power, the subversion of power, in relation to class, race, gender, ethnicity on the page. And while there are all of these similarities and resonances, your books are also quite different in terms of the positions of the characters, whose stories these are. And I'd like to ask you, Anita and Meg, to tell us a little bit about why you wanted to tell these stories, what drew you to these stories and these characters, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure. Thank you for that introduction. It's really interesting always to do these conversations because you learn things about your books that you never knew existed in your books. And you, the facilitators often make you sound much smarter than you actually are as a writer, so thank you for that. So I guess for me there was a couple of layers to it, how this book evolved and where the story came from. And one was that in 2017, Gundagai celebrated or acknowledged, remembered the 165th anniversary of the Gundagai flood of 1852, and at that, as part of that acknowledgement, unveiled a statue to Yardi and Jackie Jackie, two Wiradjuri heroes of that flood, who over the course of 3 days went out on canoes and saved between 52 and 80 lives at a time where a third of that town drowned. Now, the Great Flood of Gundagai is known as one of Australia's greatest natural disasters, and how many people in this room have heard of the Great Flood of Gundagai? So many people haven't, and I thought, not only do Australians not know about this natural disaster, they therefore do not know about these extraordinary heroes who went out in raging waters at a time when they were fringe dwellers on their own country to save not just white people, to save other human beings. And I wanted people to know that story, but I also wanted to know what I wanted Australians to understand what it was like for Wiradjuri people in particular to live on the land under a range of legislation during that point, during that moment in time. And the novel moves into Wagga and so forth and leads on to the opening of the Brungle Mission, where most of my family are from. And I wanted Australians to understand our shared history, because everything post the point of invasion is shared history. There's no such thing as Aboriginal history. The massacres, we didn't massacre ourselves. So I wanted people to understand our shared history, because I firmly believe when we do that, we better understand our present, and it's easier to move forward together into the future.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Anita, this might be a good point to do a little bit of a reading, if you would like to.
So it's really brief. I'm just going to share a little bit from the prologue. And it's actually set in 1838 because it's understood that the local Wiradjuri people had told the local white fellas, the new settlers, not to build on the floodplains. And there'd already been floods, and there were floods in 1844 that took lives. So this is, we get it just at the beginning of Wagadine. 1838, Gundagai. Not a good place to live, boss. Too flat. Wagadine looks up at her father as he speaks to a white man with piercing green eyes. He's across the way. She's a wide-eyed four-year-old girl with a spring in her step and a toothy smile that goes from ear to ear. She's bone-thin with dark brown hair that falls in large curls down her back. She loves walking along the river when her babin is not off with her uncles, and she's interested to see all the new people who are coming to live near them. Between where she stands and the billa, there are three rows of gunyagalung. She watches the current flow rapidly downstream, then turns to observe different men swinging hammers and grunting with hard work, making their gunyagalung out of wood and stones, not with branches and trees. They are building them next to each other, and it's different to their campsite, which is not so straight and not so boring, she thinks. But these gunyagalung look like they are very strong and won't ever move, ever. Wagadine recalls her father and her uncles talking about all the white people coming to live on Wiradjuri Nurumbung, our ancestors' country, they always insist to each other. She thinks the stranger across the way is so white and so skinny he could move around like a birig, but she's sure her babin wouldn't be talking to a spirit like he is a real person. She is frightened out of her dark skin as the man hisses at them both, "Go away!" Wagadine holds her breath as she looks over to the man and sees angry eyes and a furrowed forehead on a tired, pale face. She's heard her uncles talking about not building on the river flats, that it's not the right place to make a home for anyone, that it's not safe to build a house where the water will flood when it rains heavily. They know because even though they camp there and have ceremony there, they move to higher ground as soon as the rain falls hard. But these new Gunyagalung, they won't be able to be moved. She knows that this place has flooded before and it will again. She wants to tell the man herself, but she wouldn't dare. That would be disrespectful, and the one thing she must always show elders is Yinjimara. Even though the man is not her uncle, he is most definitely older than her by many, many years, so she keeps her mouth shut. After a few strides, her father turns around abruptly, swinging his daughter around with him. "Here," he says loudly and clearly to the white man as he looks from the river to his left and waves his arms from side to side. "Flood area, biggest rains. Water goes past here." He raises his hand above his head to show how high the water may rise. Wagadine thinks that her babin is very tall, so the water will be very tall too. The man scoffs. He points to the dry landscape. "You don't know what you're talking about. We need rain. It certainly doesn't look like it's going to flood to me. It hasn't flooded for the longest time," Yari says, "but it will happen again, we know." "I'm building an attic," he says. Yari doesn't respond, so the man goes on. "That's a room in the roof," he says sarcastically, "and we can go up high if there is any flooding, but I'm sure we won't have to." Yari shakes his head. "Come." Wagadine feels a gentle pull on her hand. "They never listen, Wagadine. Never listen." "Why didn't you tell him, Babin?" she asks quietly, not wanting to upset her father any more than he already is. "Tell him what?" "What Murrumbidgee means." She takes three steps to each of her father's lunges. "That it means big flood, big water." Wagadine looks up and smiles at her hero, hoping that he is proud that she remembers the stories he tells her. "No matter what you say or how many times you say it, Numa, some people, especially white people, they just won't listen. Except those at Carriage Works, they always listen." Thank you.
Absolutely stunning, and there's a lot I want to ask you in relation to what you just read, but I would love to hear from you, Meg, a little bit about what brought you to the story that you were trying to tell in The Wreck.
Well, one of the things I love about history is, as Anita was saying, what it can teach us about who we are now, and I object to this characterisation of history as something that you can rule a line under and wrap in grease paper and pop in a biscuit tin on the shelf and no longer be affected by it. Particularly Australian history, I know I'm writing about something which has caused a great deal of pain to First Nations people, and I'm always conscious of that. But more broadly, I think that we sometimes pat ourselves on the back and tell ourselves that we've come a bit further than we actually have. And I'm really interested in writing about history that holds a mirror up to ourselves, about who we are, who we still are, what we still need to change, and also about women. Our stories have been undertold. And I love writing about women who use the limited levers at their disposal to raise themselves and others up. So those two things were themes that I really wanted to explore in The Wreck. And in particular, I was very interested in this idea that we have that peaceful protest is something that we can rely on as a right. I think we've seen in recent responses to peaceful protests in democracies around the world that that's not true. And in history, we have an example in the Peterloo Massacre, which was essentially Britain's Tiananmen Square, where 60,000 people who were there to listen to a talk about parliamentary reform were waded into by a group of hussars on horseback slashing sabres. So that is the catalyst which sends my character sort of spinning off into a radical group in London and thence fleeing on a ship to New South Wales, where she tries to remake the world anew and finds that she is meeting resistance at every turn, essentially.
Yeah. Yes. I loved what you said about the different levers that the characters in your book have as women. And I think one of the levers is the name that they have, that they're given, but also that they are forced to reconsider in some ways, particularly in your book, but also in your work, Anita, the politics of naming. And I know that you're going to help us pronounce the title of the book, but I just want to, before we get to that, I want to ask you, Meg, if you could talk a little bit about the politics of naming, the politics of using those levers of the name of one's gender, etc., in order to survive, in order to accentuate certain aspects of the self, in order to de-emphasize other aspects of the self.
Yes.
I found that fascinating in your book.
Well, thank you. And I mean, women of that time really did have to, really were defined through male eyes, and had to, those who wanted to define themselves from themselves, had to find a way to either use people's underestimation of them to their advantage, or to essentially adopt protective coloration, whether that meant actively dressing as a man, whether it meant behaving as a man, or whether it simply meant chipping away in the background where they were unseen because they were women, until all of a sudden they were ready to, you know, launch their grand enterprise. And the idea of naming Rowanna, I think it's more than just how people know you. It has to do with voice. And for me in this book, naming is a sort of avatar for having a voice. If you have to change your name through circumstances, or if, with, as with Wagadine, you know, other people decide that you should be called something else, it's a means of taking your voice away. And, of course, there are some women in both novels who decide that they're not going to allow their voice to be stolen. But to me, names have always been, had a resonance with the idea of voice.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Mm. Thank you. Yeah. Anita, I'd love to hear from you about how the main character in the book, Wagadine, navigates that idea of being called and her name being distorted in many ways as well.
So the name Wagadine means dancer, and it comes from Wagga, means dance. Those of you who didn't know, Wagga Wagga for a long time was also known as the town of many crows, but the word for crow is Wagan, which is W-A-G-A-N. So I think there was confusion in terms of translation of language. And so it's actually Wagga Wagga means celebration, like many dances. So in the novel, Wagadine, post the flood, she's working for the Bradleys, who turns out to be Mr. Bradley, who is the man that she originally sees in 1838 building the house. And nobody in that family calls her by her name. So one of it is a denial of her identity. It's a denial that there is another language. And, of course, Aboriginal people weren't allowed to speak language. It was another disconnection from identity and culture that was imposed upon our people. And they call her Wilma, as if it's a completely normal thing to do. And I was just mentioning also prior to this session that the first cricket team, you'll probably know, that the Australian cricket team that went to the UK in 1868, all were given Anglo names and sashes to wear so that the people could tell them apart. You know, it's this laziness. It's not even an attempt to try and understand another culture, because the Western or Anglo culture is the superior one. So throughout my novel, what I wanted to do, and this isn't completely on point of your question, is all those characters have Wiradjuri names. And many of the brothers are named after the late Kerry Reid Gilbert's grandchildren. So I wanted to embed as much of the present and the past into this through language as well. My Wiradjuri name, we've Wiradjurized, for want of a better term. My Anita is Yanada. So there are ways of doing that. So I've done that with some of the characters' names as well. And can we do the title really quickly now?
Yes, please.
So it's Billa, and some people may have seen, I made a video for Instagram and Twitter that, you know, had 6,000 views overnight, and then I got a phone call from Aunty Elaine Lomas saying, you know, you did it wrong, Anita. So, and I can't even, we're laughing now, but I was nearly smashed my car. I was so distressed. And she said, just make another one. I'm like, no, it doesn't work like that. I can't do that. And it's being shared and everything. But because what I was saying, so it's Billa Yaradungalung Duray, and I was saying Durai. But the hours I spent that afternoon pulling that apart with my head and feeling disrespectful to my ancestors, because I want to get it right. And some people say, tomato, tomato, and that's fine. But I want to do the right thing. And what one of my sisters, my Inigalung down in Wiradjuri country, said to me, she said, Annette, you're learning what should have been your first language at 50. And I said, that's right. And it's a really complex, if we look at this, so Billa means river, Yarudung means dream, Galung is the plural, so many, and durée is the action. So the action of having many dreams. So when I was, it's a really complex language to learn. I don't even remember learning English like this when I went to school. You know, we had sentence makers and I think we learnt phonetically. So it, you have to, with the language, you, it's not a translation of English because we didn't have English. It is a way of thought. You have to think Wiradjuri in order for you to start to learn how to do the language. And so I wanted to, as Anita Heiss and as an act of sovereignty for me, speaking language is learning, and I wanted my characters, I wanted to show that on the in the camps they would have been privately still using language and so forth. That did not answer your question, but...
Oh, it totally
did. I'm sorry. I'm being a politician.
In a beautiful direction, Anita. Okay. It unfurled in very interesting ways.
Okay, thank you.
But would you like to teach us?
Oh, sure. Okay, so we'll do it together.
The title?
Billa.
Billa.
Yarudang.
Yarudang.
Galang.
Galang.
Durei.
Durei.
Now on three, let it roll off your tongue. One, two, three. Billa, Yarudang, Galang, Durei. Fluent.
Woohoo!
Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, we have all engaged in an act of sovereignty in solidarity.
Thank and you. You are part of language reclamation. Thank you.
I was interested in what you said about some of the settlers and the colonizers in the characters in your book being lazy and not wanting to actually... It's an act of laziness, refusing to see distinction in a group of people and treating them as one kind of homogenous, faceless group. And I completely agree. And I think also that there's that element of class privilege that comes in.
Absolutely.
And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, because that's also quite a huge theme in Meg's book.
It was so bizarre. There were so many similarities we didn't realise. It's wonderful. Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of it is about class. And the idea that it was a Masters and Servants Act and that Aboriginal people were obviously of lower intelligence, lower expectations. The Bradleys assumed they had lower expectations. Why would we pay them? What would they spend the money on anyway? Sort of thing. And even Louisa Spencer is the other female character where an unusual friendship is founded in the Bradley household. But Louisa comes as a Quaker. And interestingly, the connection with our books is that the Quakers, when they came to Australia in 1832, two of their key platforms were the rights of convicts and the rights of Aboriginal people. And Louisa believes in herself. She just believes that she isn't classist, but she is, because she still refuses to allow Wagadyne to have the freedom to be with her family. She still has, still uses that power, even though she claims to be a friend and she claims she wants to do all these things to give Aboriginal people their freedom and so forth. And when you see the conversations, the dialogue between Louisa and her husband, James Bradley, where Louisa is teaching him of all the things she's learned about the legislation around Aboriginal people and land and so forth, but she doesn't actually, and this is typical of things that happen today, there's a lot of lip service paid by a lot of people, but it's got to translate into action. So I think people think they're not racist or they think they don't have an element of class in their mindset, but they do.
Yeah. No, absolutely beautiful. And Meg, your book, I thought, was such a beautiful interrogation of class privilege and class position taking and the subversion of that and the hypocrisy associated when there is the possibility of benefit for some of the characters.
Yes.
Yes. And I was wondering if you would like to read a little bit first and then talk to us a little bit about your interest in the class struggles of your characters.
Thank you very much. Yes. So what I'm going to read is a scene from close to the beginning of the book, just after the Peterloo Massacre, when people are wandering around the field looking for their families. And Sarah, my central character, is looking for her brother and her parents. And meanwhile, there is a certain radical lurking around the field using this tragedy as a recruitment opportunity, because one of the other things I was interested in exploring is the link between oppression and extremism. So there had been, Sarah would learn later, upwards of 60,000 people in St. Peter's Field, But now, less than half an hour after the yeomanry had started its assault, only a few hundred remained. Some were wandering in a haze, others were bending over insensible or lifeless forms, turning them onto their backs, exhaling with relief or gasping in despair. Sarah walked around the field, yelling at the top of her lungs, "Ma, Sam, Pa." Inwardly, she cursed everyone she saw for not being her family. She was so engrossed that she jumped when a hand clasped her shoulder. "Thank God," said Sam, hugging her. Sarah's cheek was on his chest, but she could tell by the thickness in his voice that he was crying. "Where's Ma?" She shook her head. "We got separated." "Pa and I too," said Sam. "They'll have made it to safety, of course." He nodded, obviously trying to convince himself of this. Keeping in sight of each other, Sarah and Sam went from one form to the next, men who had poured out the last of their blood into the earth, some unrecognisable thanks to the horse's hooves, a woman pregnant lying on her side, another with her abdomen sliced open at an angle, probably the result of a wild flail. Here and there a child. Perhaps they had started the morning aloft on their father's shoulders, brought to see the great Mr. Hartford so that one day they could tell their grandchildren. Jack, this is their father, must have been intent on getting as close to Hartford as possible. He had been like that at the other assemblies the family had attended, angling his body sideways, worming his way eagerly through the crowd, dragging a protesting Emily by the hand. There was no other way to explain his location, not 50 feet from the cart where Hartford had started to rail against oppression just before it made itself manifest. Across Jack's chest there was a scarlet line, punctuated by the wound that had killed him, a deliberate stab, not a thoughtless slash. In the dim light from the cottage hearth, Sarah had watched that chest rise and fall in sleep. She had heard it fill with air and eject songs or jokes, endearments, shouts of anger. There was an ominous, disjointed quality to the world she had entered, one in which no more sounds would be carried out of her father's slack mouth. But she found herself watching his chest for a tiny lift she knew would not come. Eventually, the stillness became unbearable and she boiled her fists and roughly rubbed her eyes. When she opened them, she saw her mother. After Sarah had dashed back to save Delia, Emily had not gotten far. Sarah must have walked right past her, desperate to find the living, not wanting to see the dead. Emily was around 10 yards from the hustings, her chest caved in from a hoof strike, perhaps the same hoof from which Sarah had saved Delia. Sarah looked up, opened her mouth, tried to call her brother's name. Her legs lost all intention and she was on her knees, Sam drawn to her by a sound she had not intended to make, a keen she did not recognise. He knelt beside her but made no attempt to embrace her, to comfort her. Swaying a little, he seemed not to notice the tears dripping from his chin and the end of his nose into the grass. "This is their answer to our request," Sarah said, taking great draughts of air into her lungs to steady herself. "This is the answer of the Prince Regent, the Prime Minister, the Cabinet." She curled herself beside her mother, laid her head on the ruined chest. "This is what they do when we ask for food, for rights," she whispered, "what we are worth." "It cannot go unanswered," said Sam after a while. "It cannot." "It will not," said a man who had come to stand beside them without Sarah noticing. He put his hand on Sam's shoulder and helped him up. The hand, half hidden by a lace cuff, was then extended to Sarah. She took it and was raised to her feet. She looked along the arm until her gaze reached a long nose that came down almost to his top lip. Her eyes lifted to his high brow and swept back greying hair. "My name is Aidan Briardown," he said. "I will make sure your dear ones are seen to, and I promise you they will have our answer soon enough."
Mm. Thank you, Meg. That's a beautiful reading. Where were you when you wrote this?
I was sitting on the couch in the corner of the living room, tapping away and demanding hugs and chocolate and coffee from my children.
So that would have been very hard to write.
It's funny, I find with scenes like that, with very emotional scenes, obviously you have to feel it if you've got half a hope of making anyone else feel it. And there's a certain scene Anita and I were discussing in her book, which I cried when I read, and you were saying you cried when you wrote it. And with scenes like that, I find I sort of stalk around them for a couple of days. I have to sort of work my way up to them. I sort of approach and then I scuttle backwards a bit and then I approach a little bit closer and eventually I sit down to write it. But I think if you're feeling wrenched and drained and a little bit abraded by something like that after you've written it, you've probably done your job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Anita, in terms of the approach to writing a scene, a very moving, emotionally wrenching scene like that, you have different methodology.
I have the same terms of writing the emotional things. You just reminded me when you were talking, we'll talk about the plotting stuff, but I worked with Jeffrey Atherton, many years ago, maybe 20 years ago now. We were working on a TV series together, we're trying to, and he said to me, if you read something and you just smile, you know that it's funny, that it's been written really well. And so if you watch television, if you're watching TV and you smile, you know it's written really well. If you laugh out loud, you know it's great comedy. I never forgot that. So for me, it's very similar. If you're reading, something happened to me when I was writing Barbed Wire and Cherry Blossoms, the same thing. There's a scene in that I cried at. It's also in Titters. There's a very emotional scene in that. And I think as a writer, if you're not feeling that emotion, how can we expect our readers to feel that emotion as well? Mind you, I cry a lot, so, you know. But in terms of process, it's really interesting because they say there's two types of writers in the world. There's a plotter, and there's pansters. And most of my friends are pansters. And when I run workshops, I put up slides saying, well, this is what a plotter typically looks like, not physically, dot points on how we behave, and this is what a panster looks like. And most of my students are pansters. So I'm a plotter. I have a very strong methodology, very similar for every single book. I write a synopsis. Then I write character breakdowns. I map out the entire novel. Like I say it to students, I say it's like an essay plan for the book. I never get writer's block because if I get stuck on chapter 2, I know vaguely what's happening in chapter 16. So I do my research, and I sit down to write. I spend more time researching than I do actually writing because by the time I sit down to write, I've got my information and I've got my storyline. I mean, obviously it changes as you go along because you have new ideas and then your editor tells you that you've done something wrong. And then I, you know, do the first draft and I have a process where I get feedback from particularly where it's set, people who are, you know, it's elders in Brungle and Wagga and wherever, and Gundagai, and just some language speakers for this novel, people who know about historical fiction and so forth. So I have a very same methodology for regardless of genre.
Yeah, beautiful. Meg, yours is different though.
I'm what you might call a plantser. I'm a bit of a mix between the two. I would love to have the kind of brain where, like Anita, who's obviously an incredibly organised and brilliantly intelligent writer.
I don't know.
I can't do what you do quite in terms of an essay plan for the book, and I've tried and tried and tried and it just doesn't work for me. It's an interesting beast, isn't it? Everyone has their own approaches and there's no one right or wrong way, but sometimes it takes a bit of trial and error to figure out what works for you. So I write a synopsis because I like to have a general roadmap. And then I have a word limit every day in a first draft, a word count that I have to get to come hell or high water.
And what is that? What is your...
It depends where I am. First 20,000 words, about 1,500.
A day.
A day. And then I accelerate to about 2,000, 3,000 a day as I get into it, but that's only, there are sort of gaps between there because I do research in between and so on, so it's not as though I can bash out a book in 2 months or 3 months or whatever. Unfortunately, I'd love to be able to. So, and then when I sit down every day, I say, all right, this is where I am, this is where I need to be, and then I figure out at the time who needs to talk to who, what needs to happen, what conversations need to be held, what realisations have to be realised, etc., to get from A to B. So I'm a little bit in the middle. I think I would find it unutterably terrifying to just sort of have a general idea and sit down and start writing it straight away.
People do that.
I don't know
how they do that. I can't even write like a page without a plan.
Yeah.
I'm interested. There's people who are right in the audience, I know that, or people who want to write. Who thinks they would be a plotter? And a panster?
What's a panster?
Someone who flies by the seat of their pants. Oh. Men who... Yes, Michael Lynch, you're a panster.
Tom's a panster.
Okay.
Yep.
So Anita and Meg will run plotting and pantsing workshops, for which you can pay them separately.
I'm going to have three people in my workshop. I will say, though, I have 18 books out, so if you want to finish your book, it's a good plan to... plot it.
But whatever you're doing, Meg and Anita, is obviously working, because I think the foreshadowing in those first few pages, you just know you're in the hands of a great storyteller with both their books. You just know at the start when you read the books that, oh, every word here means something and there's going to be a payoff. Later on, I won't tell you what the payoff is. You'll have to read the books yourselves. But I have two more questions to ask before we open up to the audience. But I'm particularly interested, as I was reading, I was interested in your representations of femininity, of womanhood, particularly in the way your male characters look at women. And I was wondering if you could both talk a little bit about that, because I know that a lot of young women will be reading your work, and I mean, it's not just for young women, but in terms of the representation of femininity, in terms of... So in your book, Anita, in the first few pages, the father holds up, Hira holds up Wongadine on his shoulders, and there's this sense of strength and hope and potential that he sees in his daughter, as well as other things that are happening. But the other male characters look at women in very different ways. So, for example, the James Bradley character, who's extremely classist, he wants an English rose with his wife, Louisa, and she's constantly trying to resist that expectation of her. She finds it completely reductive and simplistic, etc., and narrow. The male character, who is a love interest, and his name is Yindi. Yindi's gaze upon Wongadine is quite different, you know. And I was just wondering if you could talk about the different male gazes upon the main female characters in your work, and Meg, you too, because you do something quite different. That kind of, you know, the desire for an English rose doesn't exist. Oh, it's not accessible in terms of class for your characters. But Sarah does something quite different in terms of her femininity and in order to survive. I won't say too much. I'm trying to choose my words carefully here. But I was just wondering if you could both comment on the female characters and how they are looked upon by the men in your books.
Well, in terms of my female... One of the more minor characters is a prostitute. And she is... I deliberately wanted to subvert this idea of the whore with the heart of gold, you know, because she is a generally, despite her hardships, a generally cheerful, upbeat character. And at one point, she actually says, "Do you think I enjoy this? No, I'm doing this to survive. This is all I've got. There is no way I'd be doing this if I didn't have to. But I'm not going to let them take away my ability to be... to find happiness where I can."
Really liked Nell. It's Nell,
did?
Isn't it? Yeah, I really liked Nell, yeah.
Yeah, oh, thank you. It's funny, I have read so many iterations of prostitutes, and some of them do, I think, more so in the past than now, give the impression that, oh, she likes it, you know, or, you know, she's doing it for fun or whatever. And if people were to do that, that's fine. But in this case, you know, it was... I also wanted to use Nell to demonstrate the fact that it was a very, very precarious time for women, and there were only a few paths open to them, and they didn't usually get to choose those paths. So Sarah, my central character, often chooses the path of dressing as a man, so that she can be... She likes to use invisibility where she can. So she feels that if she can wear breeches and hide her hair and smear dirt on her face to stand in for whiskers, if that can make her invisible, she'll use it. If being a woman can make her invisible, she'll use it. It's all about avoiding attention so she can do her own thing, because attention for her means death. Mm. Attention for her means she'll be arrested and hanged for taking part in an uprising. Mm. So,
yeah, that's interesting, that kind of intersection of sexuality and violence.
Absolutely, yeah. And they were both very much very much linked in colonial Australia and elsewhere, obviously throughout our history. And there was, you know, as you were saying, you were talking about male gazers, and women at that time were who men saw them as. I mean, we've had a lot of debate recently about, you know, she's not someone's daughter, she's not someone's wife, she's not someone's mother, she's not someone's sister, she's someone, you know, in relation to how we view, you know, the current issues that we're dealing with around gender equality and sexual assault. And that was to the power of 10, obviously, in the past. So there were women in real life, one of whom I've fictionalised, and I wanted to write a character who decides to subvert that and use it to her advantage.
Yeah, absolutely. And Anita, in your book, doubly so, with the intersection of race and sexuality and the constant threat of sexual violence upon
the women.
And there's
a scene, just remind me, there's a scene... you know, you write these novels and I forget like what I've written, but there's a scene where the men, the stockmen, the black and the white stockmen have been had lunch and they're sitting by the tree, and Wagadine and Louisa are up, you know, where they're serving from, and there's one of the men in particular is sexualizing Louisa Bradley. And I was just thinking then, because some of them, there's the only spark up about that was not that you shouldn't say that about women, you shouldn't say that about Louisa Bradley, because, you know, Mr. Bradley will, you know, have you for that. And then there's a mention, someone says something about Wagadine, and, you know, Yindi tenses and he's looking for the other men, waiting for a movement. But they all know that if they start a fight or they do anything physical, that they will be reprimanded and the consequences could be dire. So they're always conscious of having to hold their tongue, but he was ready to fight whatever happened. And it's interesting because Louisa does actually fight against, you know, James wants, he wants to be the mayor, he wants to have, you know, the English Rose, he calls her English Rose. There's an English Rose, interestingly, yeah, in the novel. But on their way, they're getting married and Wagadine's trying to lace up this whalebone corset and she's saying, like, what is this? Why are you doing this? So she still wants to be, you know, she dresses down, she makes a lot of her own clothes, but she's still doing what, you know, the woman does to please the man, and she goes, I want to have a flat stomach and all that sort of thing. So, yeah. And she's going, and Wagadine's thinking, I don't even know what a whale is, and I'm sure my aunties, we're always trying to eat to get fatter, not make our stomachs thinner. Like, what would they think? Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely beautiful. And it kind of brings me to my final question before we open up, which is, I think both your novels in some way are trying to address the question of what does it mean to live a good life? And that's very, very different. Anita, you were talking earlier before the session about the two different value systems that clash. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, because what a good life is for Louisa with the house and the huge estate, you know, in Wagga, is very, very different for Wagadine.
Yeah, so it's one of my favourite scenes in the novel is born out of something I heard when I was down in Wagga about the broom and the tree, and Louisa can't believe that Wagadine keeps slipping into moments of despair. She's so distraught that she's away from her Meargarn, from her family. And Louisa says, but, you know, why aren't you happy? You're here, you've got this house. She's now got her own room with a window, you know, all this sort of, you've got all of this. And Wagadine says, no, this is yours. How can I possibly be happy? How can you think I'm happy when I'm so far from home? Her happiness is being with her family, dancing with her mother and having her brothers, even though they used to torment her, having her brothers and her cousins and everybody, that is her happiness. And it's funny because last night I had dinner with 10 friends and I thought to myself, this is my happiness. You know, it's not everything. This is happiness too. But, you know, it is. And we were talking previously about different value systems. So Wiradjuri value system is about family and responsibility to and accountability to community and so forth. And that means my writing process is very different to a Western value system, which focuses on the rights of the individual And so I have a responsibility to get the story right, because also I actually don't own this language. It's not my language to, you know, I have to, I don't, this story is really for the people who call Wiradjuri country home. And so, yeah, I think it's all very personal as well. But Sarah's happiness, not to tell your story, but Sarah's happiness would have been for her family not to be murdered.
And it's right. Interesting the choices that Sarah makes without trying to give away the ending. But just in that quest for something good and something that will make her happy.
Yeah, it's some sort of self-determination. And I mean, for her, happiness is being able to control the circumstances of her own life, which she can't. I mean, throughout the book, she's sent spinning off to the other side of the world by various events which are out of her control. And she responds to that by trying to violently remake society in a way that she can control. So it's about an extreme reaction to powerlessness and voicelessness.
Yes, yeah. Which when she comes here, she recognises that yes. She's become a perpetrator herself when she sees the dispossession that is ongoing yes. of Indigenous people. And she makes a mention of that in the book.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And, you know, Anita and I have talked about this, and the efficient brutality of the British in clearing out Sydney by that stage had resulted in the fact that there weren't that many Indigenous people left in the area by the time Sarah was there. But I am exceptionally nervous about writing about a discussion that we've had about writing about Indigenous people, because I don't want to, I do want to show respect and I don't want to get it wrong. And I recognise the fact that my whole life I've been brought up on land which is unceded. And, you know, I think that there's a responsibility that comes with that. And for that reason, because I'm the beneficiary of a system which is set up to disadvantage others. The disadvantage for First Nations people is baked in structurally to this system, which I benefit from,
yeah.
which makes me part of the problem. And therefore, I do feel very nervous about writing about Indigenous people. But I think if you're writing a story set in Australia, as you said in your wonderful article, to do otherwise would be to perpetuate the terra nullius myth.
Thank you. I'm glad. I like making white people feel nervous. That's a joke. It's not helpful in any way, shape or form. But just really quickly, because I know we might take some questions from the floor. But, you know, so I read an article in The Guardian, if you haven't had a chance to look at it, it was published this week, about the fact that you can't write the great Australian novel without mentioning First Nations peoples, because wherever that novel is set on the land, traditional lands of somebody, of some clan, some nation, and it has its own spirituality system, its own political system, and its own language. And you're kidding yourself if you're thinking you're writing the great Australian novel and you have not mentioned Aboriginal people at all anywhere. So when we got on stage today, I said, this would have been a really different panel. If Meg hadn't mentioned anything in a novel, it would have been difficult. It would have been a bit uncomfortable, really. Yeah. But, yeah, so there's an article there. The Australia Council's just released a new document done by Terry Janke. You probably all know her as one of our country's greatest Indigenous intellectual property lawyers. The Australian Society of Authors, I believe, launched a new document the other day here in Sydney, also around writing protocols. I follow protocols. So if I have to do that as a Wiradjuri author, then, you know, non-Indigenous people definitely have to do it. It's not impossible. It's not impossible. It's like if you were going to write a book about, it's not the same, but if you're going to write a book about football, you're going to go to the football. You're going to learn about football. You're going to learn about the rules. You're going to learn about the policies around that. You're going to learn about all of the history around that. You're not just going to pretend you know. So whatever your subject is, if you're writing ethically and you're writing authentically and you're writing so that your readers have the best possible book that they can buy at the Sydney Writers Festival, then you're going to do all your research properly and you're going to write particularly about Aboriginal people. I ran a workshop in Melbourne at the Wheeler Centre a few years ago, and I had two sides of a whiteboard and it was about writing Indigenous characters. And I said to the group, okay, on this side of the board, I want you to write all the stereotypes you know about Aboriginal people, and on this side of the board, all the negative stereotypes, and this side of the board, all the positive stereotypes. I read things that negative things that I'd never seen before. It horrified me, right? And I said, this is the shit you do not need to write. Why can't we create a whole new genre of positive stereotypes around our people? This is the stuff. If you can't write anything that is empowering to First Nations Australians, then my suggestion is don't write anything. The end.
Beautiful. And on that note, I'd like to open it up to questions from the audience.
Hi, thank you all for the phenomenal panel as ever. I love how, Anita, in your book you talk about language as an act of sovereignty, your writing is an act of sovereignty, about reclamation, and I 100% agree it's so important for any writer to write where we not only acknowledge and work closely with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to make sure that we honour that and that we honour all the characters. And because for me, the books that you have both written is a way that's really bringing and weaving resonance in our current in our current lives and the way that we interact. And I guess, Anita, I'm keen to hear from both of you, if I may, about how you call yourself a method writer and what that means, and your, as well as your accountability to so many people. And I feel like, and Meg, I'm sorry, I don't know your work as much, but I do feel you have that deep sense of responsibility and that thing of... but also, Meg, I guess I'm interested, how have you... It's so important that as non-Indigenous people, we overcome any fear. It's about humanity and it's about how can we as writers really honour the collective responsibility of being living here and honouring humanity in all its guises. I think there's a couple of questions in there. Thanks.
Thank you, Beck.
Thank you, Rebecca Harcourt. Cheers, squad. That's a great question. Thank you, because it gives me an opportunity to say as a method writer. So I stood in the floodplains. I went to Gundagai many times, walked along the river, which is much drier than it was in parts. I went to Yari Park. I've looked at all this. So many monuments now to Yari and Jackie Jackie, which is fabulous. I got in a canoe. I paddled, whatever you do, in the water. With a group of people from some Wiradjuri mob, people who'd also travelled from Newcastle and so forth, because I wanted to, one, give it to a tribute to Yari and Jackie Jackie, but also to imagine what it might be like in the river, in this amazing Murrumbidgee Billa. Mind you, they're in raging floods in the middle of June, which is freezing, and we had a beautiful blue sky in November and, you know, working on the tan, and we had life jackets on. I fell in the river. So I fell in the river and I was scared, but I was never going to drown, right? But trying to imagine what that was like and looking at the banks and the landscape, and I stood in the floodplains of Wagga imagining what life must have been like for my ancestors, so I could write as best as I could, trying with my Wiradjuri lens and mind, what life was like on the river for Yindi's family and then where they maybe had their own family later. We try not to give too much away. That was part of the question. You go next.
In relation to that sort of method writing thing, I think, yeah, if you can, it's fantastic if you can visit the place. But it's also about, like you were saying, those sensory experiences that your characters would have had, like you were in the river and you felt a sense of that. And for me, I spent a lot of time on the water and knowing what it's like to, even in tiny seas compared to the ones I write about, knowing what it's like to have a boat climb the edge of a wave and have the wave disappear underneath and the boat come crashing down, that sort of thing. I think having that experience and feeling just that slight, you know, clench of fear is very important to conveying it, because as we were saying before, you know, you can't make someone feel something you don't feel. And there were a couple of scenes in this book where when I'd written them, I actually took my pulse and it was elevated, and I thought, okay, thank God, because that means I actually might have done an okay job. I mean, have you ever had that kind of physical Have you had that kind
I've
of physical
taken
reaction
my pulse,
to writing?
Though. That's, no. Well,
I
mean, I've had physical reactions to writing things because also, I mean, the opposite end of the spectrum is I remember not writing this novel, but I was writing Avoiding Mr. Right. I was in Maroubra in the Bowen Library, pissing myself laughing. I had tears rolling down my screen. I'm texting my sister, oh, my God, I've just written something so funny. And then I thought, imagine if it's not funny, but you think it's funny. But, right? But I go, if you don't laugh at it, no one else is going to laugh at it. Right? But it's the same sort of, because it is about emotion. It is about conjuring something that makes somebody feel something. But you know, it's Nell, because Nell was the character you're talking about, and she's quite extraordinary. So she goes out of a night to work, to make money, to feed her baby.
Yes.
But she is the most extraordinarily cheery character, and there's a sign of hope in her.
Yeah.
I feel.
Yes.
I felt for her.
I wanted her to be hopeful despite the fact that she was in a hopeless situation, and I wanted her to still have control over her own soul.
Yes.
Essentially.
Until you have to read the book.
We have time for one more very short question.
My question is, do you know of John Warner and his song called Yarri of the Wiradjuri? He's a white fella.
Yeah, I think I've got a copy of that.
That was my first introduction to...
There's quite a lot of material over time. There's poetry, there's that song... There's a lot of references and odes, I guess, to Yarri. Yeah.
Yes, and Yarri is really a central character in his musical, and was my first introduction to the disasters there. Mm. Yeah. And I just wondered if you knew of him.
I've got like so much information, but I just on that, because what I want to say and what I want, particularly, I'm going to Gundagai next week, and what I want people to know is, like, I haven't written the ultimate story on the Gundagai flood. What I've done is I've just written something that I hope complements whatever's out there, because we all read differently. So I wrote a commercial novel because some people read fiction and some people read theatre and some people read poetry. Some people read memoir, and you know, I think what I'm trying to do is just add to that body of work that's already there. Thank you.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much. And on that note, we will say a big thank you to our wonderful writers, Anita Heith and Meg Keneally.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.